Hi, Andrea.
New information states that 45% of dementia is preventable, but what does that really mean to you? Listen and learn now. In the Brain Podcast, we blend medical insights and behavior design principles to empower you in creating brain-healthy habits. We aim to demystify brain health, enhance focus, and reduce the risk of dementia down the line. So join us as we unlock the secrets of the brain, and it's all backed by science and fueled by behavior design.
I'm Dr. Shabnam Daskar. I'm a functional medicine doctor and certified tiny habits coach. I help people improve their brain health, get rid of brain fog, prevent dementia down the line.
And I'm Andrea Spyros. I'm a behavior design consultant and professional speaker, and I work with organizations to harness the power of high-performance habits to increase engagement, resilience, and well-being. Today, we are going to be talking about dementia and this new information that 45% of dementia can be reversed or improved with just 14 factors. But what does that really mean? Are there really just 14 quick and easy things that you can do? Eat a broccoli, get to bed at 8 o'clock, and suddenly your risk of dementia will decline? Shabnam, share a little bit more about this new information and your thoughts on it.
Okay. So yes, I mean, for the last several years, we've been hearing a lot of conversations about when Andrea and I are talking about dementia, we mean all kinds of dementia, and Alzheimer's disease is the commonest form of dementia. But we kind of use the term interchangeably, but there are other forms of dementia as well. So dementia and Alzheimer's kind of we are using interchangeably. And when I'm sure many of you have, you know, seen these headlines, read about them, that, you know, 40 to 45% of dementia is preventable. Now, in the last few years, we started saying potentially preventable, because the question that Andrea and I want to address today is, number one, what does it really mean when we say it's preventable? And more importantly, both of us always want to give you strategies that you can use right away. And most of the things are related to behavior. So I'm going to share my screen. And the other thing, Andrea, is today is our first video podcast. We've been on audio for so long. So if you find us looking, you know, here and there, it's because we're looking up our notes or getting used to the video format. We were hiding behind the camera earlier. Anyway, I'm going to start sharing my screen.
If you're just listening, don't worry. The image and links will be in the show notes. And also Shabnam will describe it, the image a little bit. So if you're only listening on audio right now, you'll be able to understand.
Yes. So this is a very well-known image. I'm sure many of you have seen it. This is from the Dementia Prevention Lancet Commission report of 2024. So they've had these reports coming in for quite a few years. Now, for the sake of those who are going to listen to the audio version, we are going to have the image in the podcast show notes on my website. So what it says is risk factors for dementia, and this is the 2024 update to the Standing Lancet Commission on Dementia Prevention. And it has a whole bunch of, you know, an image which has a whole lot of circles in different colors and some sweeping lines. And in that, what it says is, there are some percentages written. So they have divided it into early life, midlife, and late life. So early life is, the percentages are what could be potentially preventable. So the first one is 5%, that is early life, less education. Then is midlife, which includes hearing loss, high LDL cholesterol, that's one of the lipid numbers, depression, traumatic brain injury, physical inactivity, diabetes, smoking, hypertension, obesity, and excessive alcohol. Now, each of those percentages, and then there are late life ones, which include social isolation, air pollution, visual loss. I would actually recommend that, you know, people look at the show notes, because even if I mention all the different percentages, Most people will not, even I don't remember. But one thing that was really striking to me was, you know, hypertension, diabetes, we know these are big problems for dementia. Now, those were 2% and early life was 5%. So this is where I had to, and I don't understand statistics very well. So I had to actually go and find out, what am I missing here? So right. What this particular report is talking about is something called population attributable risk. So basically what it means is, and you can see in the, you know, the in the image, it says percentage reduction in cases of dementia if this risk factor is totally eliminated. So that means what population risk, attributable risk means, it is not my personal risk. It is if people could, you know, get rid of less education in early life all over the world, it would reduce dementia by 5%. So basically, if I were to use an example of a person, so let us say it's a 40-year-old smoker who has a PhD, and that person has uncontrolled diabetes, it does not mean, because diabetes and smoking are 2% and 2% or each, that does not mean that just because he has a PhD, his risk is lower if he doesn't, you know, maintain his blood glucose levels and doesn't stop smoking. So, right. Andrea, I know you can explain that way better than, you know, what I'm sounding. Is it making sense?
I think it's really important the way you said it. And then also I'll share a different way to say it, because it's really important to understand this. And this happens a lot in research where they will take a study and apply it. And the study is on a population. A population is a large, hopefully large group of people, right? The larger the group of people, then the better the data can be, right? If you are just going with 30 people, probably not something you want to extrapolate to 7 billion people. But if you have a very large population or group of people and you have some results for that group of people, then the temptation is for us to make it about us, right? So if the 5% reduction is in the population, the group of people, that doesn't mean everyone in the group of people has a 5% reduction. Some have none, some have way more. And so it's not take this with a grain of salt, but also recognize that this is not about an individual, right? It's about a group of people. And that is the one thing about this study that's very important to understand, is not to bring it down to the individual level, because it's meant for a group.
Thank you so much, Andrea. And another thing that, you know, you and I, we discussed ahead of time, we wanted to highlight is sometimes what happens, you know, when a condition is called potentially preventable or preventable, and if someone has that condition, so let us say someone, you know, a 70-year-old woman is diagnosed with dementia, and people are told that, oh, dementia is preventable. The fact that she could not prevent her dementia, it's kind of taken as a, oh, she did not do things that she could have done.
Right.
That is what we are like, we want to make sure that people don't think that. Just because something is potentially preventable doesn't mean everyone's going to be able to prevent that.
Exactly. And I think there's a lot of stigma and a lot of judgment in many communities over, if something is preventable and you have it, then you did something bad or wrong, or you didn't do the things you should have done. And the fact is, there's a lot of factors that go into getting any type of disease or any type of dementia, and certainly more than we can account for, right? It's very well studied, but also we don't have the grips where we can say, hey, just eat an apple in the morning and take a 3-minute walk and, you know, drink 8 ounces of water a day and don't smoke and don't drink, and then no one will get dementia. There's factors, individual factors within you that, and stress factors and trauma factors that can determine what happens for you, whether it's dementia or something else. So I think the framing for this episode is not only how preventable is it and what does that mean to you, but also thinking about what you can and will do to set you up for success, to have the least possible risk of dementia, but no judgment if things happen to you or a family member.
Yeah, and more importantly, you know, and it's not just other people telling somebody she could have done things that could have prevented this. It's also the person feeling that, you know, it's my personal shortcoming that right. I could not, you know, prevent or could not do a lot of things that I should have done. So you and I don't talk about shoulds on our podcast. And so what we will do now, Andrea and I will go over those 14 risk factors, and we will kind of give you a behavioral change or a habit change strategy for each one of those. And what we would both encourage you to do is go over your own information and see what you can do. And again, if you are not able to do something, there should be no judgment. That is the most important thing. So I'm going to go back to sharing my screen.
Yeah. And I really want to make sure people understand, like, when you share your screen, like in the screen, the first 5% reduction in the population is that, or 5% was early education, that they had less education. And so that was, 5% more likely to get dementia. And so if you're listening and you didn't have great early education, you're not doomed. Right. You're not.
Yeah. This is why I want to highlight this particular one very much, because, people who've not had, now people could have had low early life education for various reasons. It doesn't reflect their lack of intellectual ability. Mm-hmm. So it could be because of socioeconomic reasons. It could be because there was a war. It could be because they had family responsibilities. But what most early life education actually relates to is something called cognitive reserve. So people who have higher education have, cognitive reserve is, if I could, compare it to, let us say we have two different lanes reaching my home and there is construction going on in one of the lanes. So what happens is I can't use that lane, but I can use the, maybe the rear entrance, the one with the alley, back alley. So cognitive reserve is like that. If a particular part of the brain is not functioning as well, then with people with higher cognitive reserve can actually use maybe other pathways. And when we say cognitive reserve can be improved by doing many things. So if you are someone who did not have the opportunity for, higher education when you were younger, it does not mean that you are doomed, as Andrea said. You can do so many other things to learn a lot of stuff nowadays. Like self-education has a huge impact, learning a new language or learning several new languages. And so many studies have shown, older people who use computers, who learn new stuff, and there's so much of new stuff to learn, they can change their risk factors. So that is the first one of early life risk. And then in midlife, there are a whole bunch of them. Now, diabetes, hypertension are two big ones that Andrea and I have talked about them separately. So the foundations of brain health for us are optimal blood pressure levels, optimal blood glucose levels, and low levels of chronic inflammation. So we are not going to go into detail on those. But few things like hearing loss and physical inactivity. So hearing loss is supposed to reduce potentially risk by 7% and physical inactivity is about 2%. Hearing loss, we already have an episode on that. So mm-hmm. Andrea, what would you suggest for someone who is looking at the risk factor for hearing loss?
I think, first of all, testing your hearing is one of those things that would be really important to do. And so that is a great one-time action that you can just talk to your doctor, set up a hearing test, just to make sure, because sometimes you can lose certain, especially as we age, we can lose certain ranges of hearing and we just kind of go on, we get a little bit frog boiled. And so I would say number one is just get tested on that. And then if you need to get whatever hearing mechanism that works for you so you can hear better. There's a lot of information about when we stop hearing well, we stop socializing, When we stop socializing, that's another risk factor here. We become more isolated. So I would say that. And I would say also have some conversations with the people around you about what you need to hear. I have a family member who had some severe hearing loss at a pretty early age, and they got some hearing here, like a Bluetooth hearing device. And there are some things that we can all do better when we're around them. So we try to keep the room quiet, even though the device is very effective at filtering out things. We try to look at them while we're talking so that our words are projecting in the right way. And also he can see any facial expressions and things like that. So I would suggest, first and foremost, get your hearing tested. And second of all, get whatever devices you need if you do need it. And then third of all, have some conversations with the people around you, the closest to you, to set you up for success. You can continue to have those conversations. And also people, I know my mom had hearing loss, and sometimes even though I knew she had hearing loss, it would be kind of frustrating. And I would have to have a habit of reminding myself of the things I needed to do for her, right? So after my mom would ask me a question, I would turn and walk over to her and look her in the eye and answer her, as opposed to just being at the sink with the water, turning it off and saying, yeah, I'm going to get to that later. Right. So things like that are really good to do.
So with hearing, there's something really interesting is studies have shown that people who have hearing challenges, if they use a hearing aid, that can lower risk for dementia. So like Andrea described, it is one is we start, sometimes people with hearing loss don't remain as socially active. The other thing is it could be an underlying neurodegenerative process, like the underlying problems that is causing the dementia, that could also affect the hearing nerves. So the other thing I wanted to highlight from the point of view of habit change is I met somebody recently and he said, you know what? That day, my entire family was like mad at me because I couldn't hear my phone. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know why I couldn't hear my phone? Because my hearing aid was getting charged. So I didn't have my hearing aid with me.
Right.
If you are someone who's using a hearing aid, are you using it regularly? Number one. Number two is if it has to be charged, like when do you charge it? Do you charge it at night? Do you have a spare one? And the other thing is, do you have a, like, Andrea, what habit could they create where they make sure they have the hearing aid with them when they're going out, particularly? Like if they're going for a walk or in the traffic or something like that.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. So first off, they're still driving, then they definitely need to have their hearing aids right next to their car keys, right? So that you pick up your car, you pick up your hearing aids, you pick up your car keys and you do that. And then if I think that's a really good point about charging them when you charge them so that it's optimal and you're not missing calls. And then again, if you're going out for a walk, I don't go out for a walk without my phone, even though I'm never on it.
Yeah.
So you want to pair your hearing aids with something you always take on your walk. So if you lock your door, if you don't take your phone, if you lock your door, again, your hearing aid should be right next to your car keys. And then if you take your phone, they could be near your phone, right? So think about what you do specifically that you, where you would need to have them and try to stage them right near another item that you normally take with you. So if you have a purse or a wallet, they can go right near those as well so that you make sure to take them when you need them. It does take a little bit of thought and a little bit of trial and error, a little bit of revision sometimes, but you can make it work easily by pairing it with something you already do.
Yeah, that is the tiny habits method. So you pair it to something you already do and not rely on motivation and then feel bad because you left your hearing aid at home. The other thing, Andrew, you mentioned something about, taking cell phones for during a walk. I actually recommend people that they should take their cell phones because it's an emergency device.
Exactly. That's why I take mine.
I don't go anywhere without mine. And I remember my 94-year-old mother-in-law, she passed away. And I used to insist with her caregivers and my relatives that make sure she has, like, I got her a nice, this thing to hang around the neck.
Right.
And
right.
I said, make sure she always has it.
Exactly. I did the same for my mother. And, and even, you know, I'm not 94, but still, it is a safety device in these, this day and age. I live in an area, it's suburban, but we still have coyotes. And every now and then a bobcat will come around.
Oh my God.
They don't generally attack anyone. They generally are on another side of the street. But I don't necessarily want to be caught without that. And I definitely, you know, here's the thing too, where people may or may not realize this, that our hearing is really responsible for keeping us safe.
Yeah.
So if I'm on a walk, the noise of a speeding car, right? The squealing of the brakes, even someone coming running behind me, right? I need to hear those in order to keep myself safe. And people need to hear those in order to keep themselves safe, right? And we too often think like, well, I'm just going around my neighborhood. It's not a big deal, but you want to keep yourself safe. And that's part, and, you know, not only keep, prevent dementia, but keep yourself living a long life. So parents.
Yeah. And Andrea, when you talked about hearing and, you know, we were recently having a conversation in my book club where people were talking about, like, many of us go out for walks. Some of them have dogs, so they go dog walking. And so this is where, you know, personal safety is so important. So if you have earphones, you're listening to music or something, right, and you are not aware of your surroundings, as you said, you know, our hearing is one of our primary senses. If you're not aware of your surroundings, there have been, you know, thefts where someone is distracting you, you know, and here they're making away with your, you know, getting away with your purse. So,
exactly.
So these are things to be very careful about, because if I'm listening to music and I'm distracted, I'm not looking around to see, like, you can make out what is, you know, what is safe and what is not safe. Someone who's, like, you know, not making eye contact, then you, like, automatically, this thing goes up, you know?
Yeah. And it's also important to recognize too, that men and women navigate the world differently. I think women and bell curve of men, bell curve of women. We're not putting all men and women in one basket, and we're not saying that there's only two genders, but people in general navigate the world a little differently. Some have a higher tolerance for, you know, being distracted, and they feel very safe in the world. But it's really important to be aware of your surroundings, and hearing and vision are two of those ways that we keep ourselves safe.
Yeah. So in the Lancet Commission report, since we are, you know, sticking to that, I don't know, they have not included vision, but we know that vision is also extreme. So hearing, vision, and a sense of hearing, we already have a podcast episode on that. So we link it to the show notes. Again, it could be, you know, basic neurodegenerative process, which is affecting them. So vision, when it, like, our eyes are sort of the visible part of the brain. You know, that's the only part where otherwise we would have to, you know, do brain imaging and all that. So vision is something very important. So the you know, the habit, from the habit perspective, when was the last time you had your vision checked? Number one, do you struggle with, you know, vision? Do you have a problem with seeing into the distance or all those things?
Yeah.
Reading. Then the other thing is, if you have hypertension or diabetes, it is very important to get a fundoscopy. Your optometrist or your doctor will tell you what to do. Both of those conditions can impact the retina, the back of the eye, and that can be seen from the front when you have an eye examination. So when did you last have your eye test, and was it normal, or was there any changes? So those are the important, again, in the Tiny Habits world, we call some of these things one-time actions. So if you're listening or watching our podcast, maybe you want to note down, when was the last time you had an eye checkup?
Right.
And are you due for one now? Then if you are, then will you schedule your appointment right now?
Right.
Then the next, I'm looking at my notes. We talked about, you know, head trauma. And so head trauma, having a head trauma, even if you have not, like any kind of concussion, there is no mild traumatic brain injury. Even if you have not, you've not completely knocked out, any kind of head trauma increases our risk for not just dementia, for a lot of mood disorders as well. Now, this is something I learned for the first time when I was got certified by, through Dr. Daniel Amen's clinic. And I know Dr. Daniel Amen's company has worked with the Tiny Habits Academy for, you know, habit creations. So Dr. Amen talks about, you know, so many times the one of the things that people forget and is often missed out is having a head trauma. You know, maybe someone was fixing the shingles on the roof and they fell from there.
Yeah. Or even a soccer ball hit you in the head. Yeah. Football, you know, things that you might consider quote unquote normal, right? I was snowboarding and I hit my head snowboarding, and it was really, and I said to a friend later on that evening or the next day, I said, wow, it was really interesting because I hit my head on the, you know, hard snow, and then I felt my brain hit the inside of my head. And that was really weird. And my friend looked at me and said, you know, that's a concussion, right? And I had no idea. I just thought a concussion was you blacked out or something like that. And it woke me up to you know, really, it doesn't have to be as hard as you think. So especially if you have someone who plays sports, football, even baseball, things like that, where you can get knocked about, knocked into by other people, things like that.
Yeah, and we will do an entire episode on head trauma because I realize suddenly we have so much to talk about.
Yeah.
Another thing, we do have an episode on the APOE4 gene. So someone who has one or two variations of the APOE4 genes at a higher risk for dementias like Alzheimer's, if they have a head trauma, the risk is even higher in them. So just wait for the episode on the head trauma. But remember that even if you've had what is called a minor, like Andrea, what you were describing, even that is significant. Sometimes it can even cause hormone imbalances because, of course, we have a whole lot of hormone-producing glands in the brain. But then we are going to run out of time. Now, smoking, alcohol, I don't think we need to talk about them. Everyone knows.
Right. Everyone knows. And if you're one of those people that there's many, many resources for smoking cessation and decreasing your alcohol, we actually have some Tiny Habits coaches who work with people in these areas. So you can go to tinyhabitsacademy.com and look at certified coaches for those things to help you actually do the behaviors that you need to do, because they're not necessarily those are type of things that you might need support for.
Yeah. And if you have like an alcohol use disorder and you need expert help for that, please don't feel, you feel free to reach out to the experts. Then, you know, I'm just going to use motivation and willpower will not do it. But the good thing that, you know, Andrea and I always want to give a message of hope. So let us say you are not someone who has an alcohol use disorder. You're not dependent on alcohol, but you would like to reduce your drinking with, you know, when you get together with friends and things like that. Studies have shown that if you reduce your daily drinking by even one drink, like instead of two glasses of wine, you're just drinking one glass of wine, even that can have huge beneficial impact on your heart disease risk, brain health risk. And the other thing, Andrea, we talk about alcohol is, you know, how you change your environment. If you're trying to drink less, don't buy a crate of, you know, red wine.
Don't buy a big box of wine, right?
Yeah. Okay, so that takes care of smoke. And lipids also, I'm not going to talk about. So lipids, cholesterol, because that itself is like, I think that's like several episodes. So yes, we're going to talk about that on several episodes. Then the other thing is depression. So here again, you know, depression, meaning untreated depression, is one big one. The other thing is sometimes people who have early cognitive decline, and many of you may notice it in your, you know, loved ones or friends or anyone, that they seem to have mood disorders earlier, and it could be a red flag. So they need to be tested for dementia. And sometimes, you know, people dismiss off some of these things as, oh, no, they're just, you know, they're just getting cranky or, you know, just an irritable old man kind of things. So rather than dismissing any change of behavior, it's better to make sure that and for some reason suddenly I don't see Andrea. Okay, Andrea, you're back.
Oh, sorry, I don't know what happened there.
Anyway, doesn't matter. Something happened. The tech glitches got in the way.
Yeah.
So depression was what we were talking about, traumatic head injury. Then, that I realized my vision, I have to go for my eye checkup. We talked about smoking. We talked about hypertension. We talked about sleep. We have, Andrew, we have four episodes on sleep.
Four or five episodes. On sleep. There's a whole playlist on sleep.
Yeah. So, good Lord, this particular episode is going to have really extensive show notes.
Yes.
Then, what was the other one? Social isolation. Also, we have an entire episode with Amy on that.
Yes, with Amy Vest, we have an entire episode on how to be more social, stay connected, deepen your connections. Even, I think that there was some information out that even just those connections with a store clerk, right?
Yeah.
A barista, a shopping clerk, those things that you do normally, if you go to the dry cleaners or just the hi, hello, how are you? What's new today? What are your plans for the weekend? That those little conversations can actually buoy your sense of connectedness.
Okay, then we talked about depression, traumatic brain injury, physical inactivity. So physical inactivity, again, we did have an episode with Jeff on that. So mm-hmm. One of the things that I often talk about is sedentariness. So we all know that exercise is good for the brain. And even despite knowing that we need to exercise at moderate to higher intensity for at least 150 to 300 minutes a week, whatever way you want to divide it. I am somebody who struggles to meet that. And there are various reasons. So, but along with lack of physical activity, there is another big factor we're talking about, sedentariness. And I have a sedentariness calculator. I'll post that link on the show. Yes,
interesting.
So just, and even if you don't go through the entire calculation, just calculate which are your biggest stretches of sitting. So for a lot of people, like, for example, someone has a half an hour commute twice a day. So that's 1 hour. Now that commute, you cannot change that continuous sitting because you have to sit and drive the car. No. Then things like when you're eating your food, yes, you should sit down and eat your food. Those are not things you can change, but it is the continuous sitting continuously for 3 hours or longer at a stretch has a lot of harmful effects, like, increased inflammation, blood glucose levels going up, more of muscles, joints, pains, aches, everything, those, all the bad stuff that you don't want to happen.
Yeah.
So one of the things that happens to a lot of people is a lot of sitting continuously at work. And Andrea, I know there is one particular habit that a lot of people like is, if you are someone who has a lot of phone calls throughout the day as a part of your work, can you do something like walking when you're on the phone?
Yeah, walk,
so Andrea, what is our favorite tiny habits recipe for that?
I have a walk and talk. I when I want to connect with people, I say, can we do a walk and talk? Or if someone texts me or messages me and says, can we have a meeting? Unless we need to do a Zoom or we need to screen share or we're going to, work on a document together or something like that. I say, so after when someone asks me for a meeting, I say, can we do a walk and talk? And we hop on the phone and we schedule it at a time where we can both walk on the phone, or at least I can. And then I do a walk and talk and it's much more enjoyable. It gets me moving. And a lot of times people really appreciate it because they're so stuck on Zoom meetings staring at the computer, staring at the green light, that it's refreshing to have me say, hey, let's do a walk and talk, right? Gives them an excuse to get outside and move.
Yeah. So walking meetings is one. The other thing is if it's not a meeting and you're just, taking phone calls from home, my patients love this habit. The habit is, as soon as I hear my phone ring, and provided, of course, you want to take the call. So the moment you click or you know, punch or whatever you do to accept the call, you stand up and start walking. And even if it's a very small place at home, you don't have a huge office, it doesn't matter. You can keep walking, make sure it's safe for you to do. So the other thing is you'll need, you know, either earphones or even a wired one, because you can't keep, you know, putting the phone here next to your ears all the time.
Yeah. So make sure you're walking around your house. Like I do a walk. Yeah. Calls me on the phone where we say, okay, wait, we need to have a quick phone call on that. I pop them on speaker. I let them know, hey, yeah. I'm alone. You're on speaker. And I literally do what you just said. I walk my house. I have a little that I walk around, I go down the hall, I go through my living room, I go through my kitchen, around into my big room and back down the hall and you know, kind of make a loop of it while I'm talking. And again, it's subtle. And I think, you know, people tend to think about movement and physical activity as something that they have to do and maybe something that they don't like to do. But think about the things that you do like to do, even like gardening, or if you like to take a bike by the beach, or a bike in the mountains, or a walk in around your neighborhood. If you just like to do those things, then those are all forms of physical activity.
Yeah.
And even just the little activity you do where you, you know, get up and go to the kitchen to get a snack, or get up and tidy something, or you're cleaning this, or you're putting away that. Those things count as physical activity. Now, they're not necessarily going to get your heart rate up where you need to be. That's a separate design issue. But think about that general activity level that you have, and even something like standing at your desk.
Yep.
Right? Even standing at your desk or getting a balance board or something like that, where you're not just standing, you can actually move your body a little bit, gain your sense of balance. Again, that's not getting your heart rate up, but it's still better than being sedentary. So there's lots of little things you can do, small changes that you can make. And then just think about the activities that you enjoy. Roller skating, biking, hiking, swimming, whatever it is for you that you already like to do.
Everything counts. And the other thing is, you know, Andrea, you said, you know, standing meetings. So I made sure that I got rid of the chair in my home office. And if my son brings it back, I push it under the table so that I can see it. And I have a sit-stand table. So I make sure that it is always set at the standing level and not at the sitting level, so that I'm not even tempted to sit down.
Yeah.
But very important, you can't stand the whole day. No. So you have to interrupt standing and sitting. And another important thing that I sometimes forget, I'm standing on a thick rubber mat. So this is an anti-fatigue mat. So then I never feel, you know, unpleasant because I'm standing for so long, because I can move around on that, you know, mat. It has some bumps and ridges on it. So, you know, so make sure that you set yourself up for success, you know, not that, oh, I feel so uncomfortable because my, you know, shoulder is thing like that, because my keyboard is not at the right level. Make sure those things work before telling yourself that habit doesn't work for you.
It's true. And there's a lot of times where we're, especially laptops and laptops and things like that, don't set our bodies up for success in terms of fatigue, right? Especially if they're on our lap, we don't have like a good ergonomic position. So it's really important to take a look at that at some point. Now, in the grand scheme of things, once we get through, we should talk about where people should start. But I want to finish
this. So I just want to be mindful of the time, because so we talked about interrupting continuous sitting. So reducing sedentariness. Another thing, because I know a lot of people, they spend time watching TV. So can you, you know, club your favorite TV program with something that you can do? Maybe you have a treadmill that is just sitting around in the garage, not being used. Can you pull it next to the TV?
Right, or some type of physical activity, or even create some tiny habit recipes if you don't have total free streaming, or total commercial free streaming, I should say. A Tiny Habits coach that I knew, he would, when a commercial would come on, he'd get down and plank.
Yeah.
Do a plank for the duration of the commercial. Or somebody else I knew would do squats for at least the first commercial. So there's also things like that that you can work in that are strength building, or, you know, some people would do a stretch or something like that, so that you, and it doesn't mean that you can never sit down and relax and stream a show.
Really,
I'm not saying that. It's just if you're trying to incorporate a little bit more physical activity, you can think about these ways to kind of sneak them in a way that's pleasant and palatable that you can get yourself to do.
Yeah. So Andrea, when you talked about, you know, ads, so here is where in the Tiny Habits world, we say we don't talk about shoulds. Yeah. So you have to choose what you like. So someone like me, I hate those ads that interrupt. So I would go and buy the subscription and not wait for that ad to interrupt me. But yeah, at the same time, I would find some other, like one of the things I use sometimes is one of those hand grip things. And we'll talk about that another day. So I have those two on the table near the TV, or I sit on a stability ball. That's another one. So there are so many different ways of interrupting continuous sitting. And one thing is I made a mistake when I was talking about, you know, visual loss not being one of the things in the Lancet Commission report. It is there. So yeah, visual loss and hearing loss we talked about. Yeah. So vision loss is there. That was the new one that was added in 2024. And we talked about it already. Yeah. So Andrea, in summary, what are the things that people can do?
Here's the thing that I always, here's the overarching question that I always say, because it can be really overwhelming. We just talked for however long on a lot of things you can do. And sometimes it can be a little bit too much and you think, where can I start? So that's number one. Number two could be, you could feel super, super motivated. I want to do it all. And then you try to put a whole bunch of new things in to your world and it only lasts for so long. That's totally normal, right? And what I suggest is pick one or two things that you want to do, very specific, right? Very specific actions that you can do. And here's the, what I call the fast pass question. What can I get myself to do that will have impact on, let's say, preventing dementia, right? And that encompasses the factors of behavior in the FOG behavior model, motivation and ability, those two things you need, and then you need a prompt. So when you say, what can I get myself to do? It means you can do it. It means you have ability. And then it means you want to do it, right? Yeah. Because you can get yourself to do it. And then pick something very small. So if you want to sit a little bit less, pick one action you can take. Maybe it's doing a plank during a commercial, or maybe it's standing for the first part of your Zoom meetings, right? Or for the first Zoom meeting of the day. Pick something very, very specific that you can do consistently and then do that. And you know, if you want to pick two, that's great. You can do that as well, but don't pick too many. Get those under your belt. Yeah. Choose things you can do and that you want to do that you think are going to have impact. And then do those. And you, I think too, those are great things to put. You can always get free human coaching at tinyhabits.com/join by a certified Tiny Habits coach, probably one of our colleagues, maybe someone I trained. And they can help you really refine the habits that you want to create so that, and then help you during the week through email to get these done. So you have a sense of empowerment and a new sense of identity at the end of the week.
Yeah, that was fantastic. So again, Andrea and I would always recommend that don't start with the most difficult thing. Mm-hmm. If you want to, let us say it's alcohol, you want to reduce your alcohol intake. Don't start with that if that is the most difficult thing you're going to do. Don't start with changing your food if that is going to be difficult for you. Start with something like, you know, walking during meetings, during your phone calls, or like, what is the small little thing you see yourself doing? And it's also, maybe all you want to do is just set up an appointment for your vision check. Yeah. That's good for the brain. Yeah.
Exactly. I think it's so well said, Shabnam, that it really is start where it's easiest for you and don't start with stopping.
Right? No, don't start with stopping. I want to stop smoking. I want to stop drinking. No, don't stop.
Just start with something that you can get yourself to do because you're going to build success momentum. And once you have success momentum, success breeds success, and you'll find yourself doing those harder and harder things. So there's going to be lots of information in the show notes for you today. Remember, you have support at tinyhabits.com/join. You can always get a live human coach every week to coach you via email. If you, the image will be in the show notes, that link will be in the show notes. We have tons of other podcasts that go deeper into the areas that affect dementia that are listed, and you can see them at the website, drcarr.com/podcast. And we look forward to your comments and hope you like, rate, share, and subscribe.
Yes, and I do hope you like our first video podcast. Thank you very much. Bye now.